Now we can start.
This is Carolyn Crabtree. I'm in the home of Dr. Eugene Connor in Louisville, Kentucky, interviewing him for the McDowell House Project. The date is November the 11th, Veterans Day, 2009. Dr. Connor, thank you so much for doing this interview with us, with me.
You're welcome.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and your connection to the McDowell House.
Well, I guess...
get it started again.
Now
okay.
Running.
Dr. Connor, tell me a little bit about yourself and the McDowell House, your connection there.
Since I taught history here and in Philadelphia, medical history here in Philadelphia, when I came here, I hadn't been here very long, and they invited me to be a member of the board at the McDowell House. And I guess now I'm about the only one that hasn't died. the oldest one, anyway.
Well, I interviewed Dr. Courtney, I believe.
Yeah, he's...
He's been on there quite a while.
Yeah.
Too, And Jim Thomas.
Jim Thomas, yep.
So, how did you find out about the McDowell House? How did you become interested in it?
Well, I knew about it from reading about McDowell. I've known about McDowell since 40, 50 years ago, before I even came here.
And you came here from where?
Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania. Actually, I came here from where the university had sent me across the wall, so-called, to Philadelphia General Hospital. I came here from there.
So did you come here as a medical doctor or as
a teacher of history? I came here as the professor of anesthesiology at the medical school.
At Louisville?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had been a teacher at Penn. Medical teacher.
So did you actually practice medicine?
Yes, ma'am.
In Louisville, too?
Well, I sure did at the Methodist Hospital and at the General Hospital.
All right. As an anesthesiologist.
Right.
Okay. What is mainly your role as a board member there? I know some of the board members are more interested in furnishings, some are interested in the building, some are interested in the history.
Well, I've been interested in mostly in McDowell himself and what he did there, and we are concerned officially with the maintenance of the house and what it represents. And I guess that's about the focus I've had is the house and the doctor himself. He's a fabulous fellow.
Tell me why you feel that way. Is he more important than other doctors would have been during that time period?
Damn right.
Why do you feel that
way?
Here
he is in a remote area in a sparsely settled part of our country where he is the best known physician. In fact, he really was. He was the best known physician in this part of the country. People came from Ohio to see him. They came from Tennessee to see him, from Western Virginia to see him.
Really?
Yeah, we have records of it. Or we know who he... We don't have any records. He didn't keep any. But we know from correspondence that he took care of patients from Ohio, Tennessee, Virginia, because there was no West Virginia then. And I guess he may have taken care of people further east. I don't know for sure. But he was well known, and the reason he's so important, he had the courage to open the peritoneal cavity in somebody, in a patient, and he had a, and they lived. Because he didn't rummage around, he knew exactly what he was gonna do, and he got in there and did it and got out. And he was in a remote area of the country where he didn't go circulate a whole lot. After he got it back from Edinburgh, he didn't go too many places, I guess. And so he wasn't contaminated by big cities.
What about big cities would have contaminated him?
His hands.
Oh, I see. You mean physically contaminated?
Hell yes.
I didn't know if you meant that or...
Oh, no.
As a doctor.
No.
Give him different ideas that probably wouldn't have...
No, he was here. And there was nobody to ask. Nobody. He had been in Philadelphia, and maybe he discussed the possibility. Well, I know that they said something about it, that you don't do it. You can't do it. Yeah, I expect he figured out you can do it.
Do you believe he was the kind of man that would have taken that as a challenge? Or do you believe he just did his work?
He just did his work. He saw what needed to be done and did it. And he didn't have to ask anybody.
What do you believe made him so famous in other parts of the country that people would come here? How would they hear about him?
Well, I suspect it's mostly word of mouth. And you wonder how from Danville, Kentucky, you get word of mouth to go very far. But everybody in the legislature knew who he was because his father was in the legislature. His father had been governor. In fact, he came here from Virginia to be governor. So everybody knew the family very well. You know, they knew about him, and they knew he had been to Edinburgh to go to medical school, which there weren't too many of them here that had done that. In fact, that's an interesting question. I don't remember if there were any in this area that had ever been to school, some of them, that practiced medicine. You didn't have to go to school to practice medicine.
Now, the doctors who came to get him, to take him down to Greene County to examine Jane Todd Crawford,
yeah.
Where would they have been trained and how? Do we know anything about them? Why would...
Yeah, but off the top of my head, I can't tell you anything about them. There were at least three that knew that he had was a good surgeon. See, Kentucky still has a very high incidence of bladder and renal stones. And he had done a lot of extractions of stones from the bladder. And so he was well known as a surgeon. And his mortality rate was so low that they didn't know how he did it. But I think the reason his mortality rate was low, he knew what he was going to do, and he went in there and did it and got out.
Now, was this a period of time when hygiene was something that they really, all the doctors used when they did surgery, or did he just happen to be one who did this?
No, this is 1809, and the concept of contamination was not yet thought about. And so he was just, he had clean hands, and I guess it's his personal hygiene. He washed his hands mm-hmm. often. I don't know that he did, but I presume that he did.
Well, one account says that he actually cleaned the organs before he put them back into her body some way.
That's a bunch of crap.
Okay.
Bunch of crap.
Okay.
That's people talking that don't know anything about operating. They don't know anything about surgery, and they just think it sounds nice.
Okay.
Didn't know such a damn thing.
All right.
He wouldn't have done that at all. Nobody would.
Can you tell us anything about the surgery he did on James K. Polk?
Well, all he did was cut a hole in the bladder and take the bladder stone out.
Okay. Did he come up from Tennessee, or was
That's
he...
That's right.
Was he already a president at the time, or had he run for president
or
he just...
18-9.
I don't remember the dates of when he was president.
He hadn't been president yet. He was a long way from president. Because he was a young man. I can't remember how old he was. I think he was 17 or 18.
Okay.
And he needed... A stone in the bladder is a very bad, annoying, painful condition. And people would submit to almost anything to get the...
Now, you said Kentucky still has quite a few of problems with that.
Yeah, they do.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think it's just the water we drink. And this is probably not the same incidence of bladder and renal stones as in 1809, but certainly it's a pretty high incidence.
Okay.
What it has to do with diet and drinking habits, water, whether you drink water or not. Of course, a lot of people knew that you didn't drink water. That's the reason whiskey's so good. that they knew that water was a source of infection, of sickness,
right.
And no infection, nothing.
Cholera and other things.
Well, cholera didn't come to the United States until 1812, I think. So cholera wasn't a threat. Wasn't even an understanding. Nah.
What do you admire most about him? Have you studied his life and his relationship with other people? What do you admire the most about him, other than his surgery?
Well, he was apparently a very good teacher. I mean, he would tell people, write it out, and send them a letter if they wanted to know something about ovarian tumors or pelvic problems. He'd write it out. He was a good writer and a good teacher. And I'm sure some of them went to see him just to inquire or to watch him.
So it appears that he had the personality of a man who was more interested in just helping people and doing his work than becoming a famous physician or someone
that
was well.
Oh, he didn't care about fame, not one bit. And I doubt if he even knew it. Because it wasn't something that was of any interest to him, I don't believe. And the people there, he was famous for all around Danville and probably Kentucky and even into Ohio and Virginia and Tennessee. But it didn't mean anything to him. It wasn't something that he strove for. He just happened to be there and be good.
How do you feel like he would be treated today as a physician? By other physicians and by people in general?
Well, apparently he was a personable gentleman, very well-mannered and everything, and people would admire him. And if they knew somebody who had been relieved of their bladder stone by him, why, they would certainly from that patient learn how much he was thought of.
Was he also a just a general physician?
Oh, certainly.
To people, or?
Certainly. He took care of all kinds of things. Vaccinated people. He was an early vaccinator in Danville.
For what, smallpox?
Yeah, against smallpox. Yeah. And
you never hear those type of things about him.
It's too bad.
I know.
People don't read.
Are there any good books that you feel like are really good books about him that have been written?
Yeah, there's only one, and take me a minute to think who it was written by. Take me longer now, I think. It was written, in the 40s, I guess, 1840s. Can't think of who wrote it now. I'll go downstairs and get it in a minute.
No, that's okay. I was just wondering. Because it seems like a lot of the books that you see about him are, well, like there's one out by a local, Dr. Grider, I believe. Maybe his was on Isaac Shelby.
He was a pharmacist.
Uh-huh. I'm not sure if he wrote about McDowell, now that I think about it. It may have been Shelby. But I don't know. I just don't seem to run across books that give the whole life and perspective of Dr. McDowell the way...
Well, there's really only one that's very reliable. I'll go get it so I can tell you who wrote it. But... a lot of people have said what he did, and they don't have any idea what he did. They take it from somebody else who didn't know what he did, or how he did it, or why it was important. There's a lot of misinformation about Doctor, not about him himself. Because there's a really good biography of him, but if people would read it, many of them don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you think about so-and-so? Well, the hell, they'll tell you. And they don't have one iota of information that's reliable. It's just somebody told them.
Like Daniel Boone.
same crap.
More legend
same
than
crap.
Truth.
Can't believe anything what they say about Boone, except he died in Missouri.
And his body's been moved back to Kentucky, and he probably hates the whole idea.
Yeah. Oh, that's... I think that was very unkind and disrespectful myself.
Dr. Courtney was telling me that this has nothing to do with why we're here, but people were trying to get Benjamin Logan moved back to Stanford.
Uh-huh.
From where he is buried near Shelbyville. And so he really told him to leave him alone.
Yeah. Dr. Courtney is very well informed.
I had a great interview with him. I enjoyed that.
He went to the University of Pennsylvania to medical school. Yes, indeed. That's the best medical school in the country when he went there. It's still pretty damn good. Despite what Harvard thinks.
The school here in Louisville.
Yeah.
Now this is another story, I'm not sure if it's true or not. Maybe you can clear it up for me. Dr. Goldsmith, who helped or assisted Dr. McDowell at times there in Danville.
Yes. Alban Gilpin Smith.
Yes. Well, he changed
Goldsmith. When he got to New York.
Now, is it true that he started the medical school here in Louisville? That was my understanding.
No, I don't think
so. That he attended Transylvania.
Yeah.
And that there was some
sort of... He got the first charter for the medical school here, a medical school here. And so, in that sense, he did start the medical school in Louisville.
Is that what is now the University of Louisville Medical School,
yes,
or is that something different?
Yes, you can tell. Yeah. See, there were at least 5 or 6 medical schools here. 6, counting the black.
In Louisville?
Yes, indeed, at one time. And the University of Louisville Medical School, which was known as first as the Louisville Medical College was the name of it when it was chartered. And they absorbed some of the other schools, and some of the other schools absorbed schools, so eventually it came down to just one, the University of the Louisville Medical Institute, or Louisville, University of Louisville Medical School.
Now, how long have you been teaching here? Are you still teaching here?
Yeah, I give lectures, but not to the medical school very often. But I still give lectures, invited lectures and stuff. But I've been here since 1950. I think that's right. Damn, it's been so long ago.
Well, my husband has a relative who graduated from the school here.
Uh-huh.
He was a medical doctor down in Campbellsville.
Uh-huh.
With Bill Shepherd. His family was connected in here with Louisville.
Uh-huh.
Also, his family were ministers, Methodist ministers. But he was an anesthesiologist down there.
Uh-huh.
And a general practitioner.
Yeah.
But he always felt that this was one of the best schools you could go to in the nation here.
Well, let me ask you this.
But how he graduated many, there.
Yeah, how many schools had he been to? How many schools had he visited? See, I've visited most of the medical schools in the United States.
What makes some better than others?
Oh, I think in McDowell's day, it was who had the clinical facilities. The reason this school here, the Louisville Medical Institute, gained so much fame was because it had the general hospital here, which they were responsible for caring the patients there, for the care of the patients there. And you could start a medical school anywhere you want, in the backyard if you wanted. And if you got people fool enough to come to the classes, that was all that was necessary.
Is that what was different about Edinburgh versus some other place that McDowell
would
have gone?
Edinburgh was a chartered university in Scotland, and they had a medical department or medical school that was first rate, and they also had clinical facilities. The physicians that taught there, their patients, the students could look at and examine. And there was a small hospital there. Hospitals weren't that common in that day. I guess the first hospital in America of any importance was the Pennsylvania Hospital, started by the Quakers in Philadelphia. And that was mostly to take care of indigents that had no place to stay and people who were psychotic.
Really?
Yeah. That's the two primary purposes.
Were those the primary purposes of any hospital during that period of time?
Well, they took care of indigents, certainly. And many of them that they had, if they were indigent, if they took care of them, they'd get well and they'd stay there and work. So it was important to the hospital that some of these people did stay there and work. I don't know what they got paid or if they got paid.
Were most of these hospitals, like Edinburgh, for example, were they, that was a university, But was it connected with any kind of church or religion or... I mean, I know we have many Catholic hospitals and Methodist hospitals and Presbyterian and various things now. Were most of them started that way?
Well, I guess the Pennsylvania Hospital, if you consider the Quakers a religion, which it indeed is, it was started. But it was by public subscription. People gave money to it. Not Quakers entirely or exclusively.
Why would McDowell not have gone to that particular hospital since it was so much closer than going to Scala?
Well, it didn't have a medical school attached to it.
Oh, it didn't?
No, indeed. The University of Pennsylvania was not attached to the Pennsylvania Hospital.
Oh, okay. So that was what was really important.
And damn it, it still isn't, if you ask them.
So it was very important to him to go to a school where they had the clinical
hospital. Yeah, I believe that's... he was a bright man, and he wanted to be educated not only in science of medicine, but in clinical care of patients. That's the reason he went to Edinburgh, I believe, because they emphasize clinical care.
I realize it was not as important to have a degree when you came away from that school, but do you believe that he actually intended to have a degree when he came here and just didn't stay long enough to get it, or?
I doubt that he cared one iota whether he had a degree or not. And most of the patients that he had or that were known about him didn't care whether he had one or not. And he did, I don't know whether he graduated or not, or whether he had a diploma, and he didn't need one. I've interviewed doctors who practiced here. They didn't have a diploma when I first came here. And they practiced.
Oh, really?
Oh, hell yeah.
That was allowed here?
Well, certainly. Not when I came here, there were people 50 years old or had been practicing 50 years. And I, through the medical society, medical community, I got to know some of them and talk with them and visit them. I went down in the country here, a lot of places, to see these people and interview them.
Did they get their training, most of them?
Locally. From the local doctor.
Working with another doctor.
Uh-huh.
Apprenticeship type of work.
Apprenticeship, yeah, whatever you call it. That's the best training there is.
I agree with you.
And our internship is an apprenticeship of sorts. Our residency training is an apprenticeship of sorts.
I guess I hadn't thought of it that way, but it is.
It sure is.
Now, there was some question. There have been some questions about his father, Dr. McDowell's father, Samuel McDowell.
Yeah.
That he wasn't as interested in McDowell going to medical school. But have you ever read anything that indicated that? Because I find it hard to believe. I find that from what I read about his father, he would have been a man who would have been pleased for his son to be a doctor.
Well, trying to figure out what the McDowell family wanted and expected of their most famous son is awful hard to tell. There's been so much hooey written and published, and people read that and they think this is the last word. Well, it's not. It's an imaginary last word. And
well, they used the fact that he didn't send him the money to finish.
Hell, he didn't have any money.
Well, he seemed to be a wealthy man, but it was always wealth tied up in land.
Well,
those
yeah.
kind of things.
Yeah. Are you going to go sell 10 acres today for cash? No. You can't do it today. And he couldn't. He had lots of land. He'd taken land in
right.
payment.
Right.
And but converting that to money to go to Philadelphia is hard to do. I think Dr. McDowell himself, as a student, probably made his own way at that time. Hell, at 18-9, sure, he could have made his living. He could have practiced medicine when he went to Philadelphia.
Were there ever any other members of his family before that would have encouraged him to want to go into medicine?
I don't know.
This is just something that came out of
his
him.
Interest. Yeah. As near as I know now, maybe there's other information, but I'm not aware of it. I think he was mostly self-motivated. Nobody had to tell him what to do, or where to go to school, or go to school. He was apparently taught first the elements, reading and writing and arithmetic, by an itinerant teacher that. Excuse me, the father knew, but you know, then if you had a person that came and was known in the local community as a teacher, you didn't ask him for a certificate, he didn't have any.
Well, Danville was a little different in that they went out and requested certain people to come and be tutors for their children. Dr. Fry. And some of these other men from...
Yeah, well, they would go to get a tutor.
They would get...
And they'd go to Cincinnati or go to Richmond or whatever. But they would rely on other people's say-so that this tutor knew what he was talking about. I guess some of them got misinformation, but...
Well, they seem to have come. A lot of these people in Danville came from the same area of Virginia. They came from Robridge County, most of them. Dr.
Yes.
McDowell and
his,
Samuel McDowell and his family. And the only ones I found that seemed like the Cowells and various ones came from there. And they had certain teachers that they brought with them or went back to get to come to Danville.
If they could persuade them to come.
Mm-hmm. That seemed to be a very important thing for those people, educating their children, including the girls.
Yeah.
Seemed to be well educated. Dr. McDowell's sisters.
Yeah, both could read and write.
Seemed to be well educated girls. And
yeah, reading and writing and doing arithmetic was an education. And of course, he didn't bother to teach the girls that because they were supposed to cook. Yeah.
They had to run homes and things like that,
right.
though.
Yeah, but so they learned, they taught themselves to add and subtract. Have you ever read any old recipes?
Oh, yes.
Well, God darn, you know then. You know how much you put in there? A pinch. Two pinches. Or one pinch. Well, I don't know what a pinch is.
I do.
Yeah, so do I. I've seen my mother do it.
What other things do you want to tell us about Dr. McDowell on this tape? That what I'm trying to do is... What I would like to do is get rid of all the traditional stuff that really we don't know for sure and get down and find out what we really know about him, you know, what's true. versus what's tradition. Are there any other traditions about him that you feel like need to be examined a little bit that aren't true? All this controversy, for example, after the surgery.
Well, that was generated by the people in Great Britain who didn't believe some hick in somewhere in America could do this. So they didn't believe him.
How long did it take, really, before they started to believe him?
I don't really know. But it was long enough that it's to their discredit. And because other people in America went and saw him operate and talked with him and stayed with him, stayed in his house. And so the Americans treated him, I think, as he should have been treated. He was not disparaged at all that I know of by Americans. So, because all the people knew him. They knew his father. And he came here as governor from Virginia, appointed governor. Well, he sat down here to be governor. So I think he, I don't know whether he saw that that he needed to be a surgeon, that there was a great need for it. I don't know. I really don't. And I'm not sure that he ever declared that he was needed there. He wanted to go to medical school, so he went to Philadelphia, the best medical school in America. And in fact, there was, there were a lot of schools that weren't schools that said they were. They had charters from the state, and we had the schools here, three or four of them were chartered, but they weren't worth much as school.
What about the one at Transylvania University? What kind of reputation did it have?
It was a good school because it was the only one. There was none other, and it was the first. And the people that started it, two doctors, two physicians, they were medical graduates from Edinburgh.
Really?
Yes, indeed. And then Samuel Brown came along, and he was a graduate of Edinburgh. But Ephraim McDowell didn't have anything to do with the school in Lexington.
Do you know why?
Too far away.
Oh, really?
How many days are you going to ride on horseback to get from Lexington to Danville? It'd take a whole damn day. And you'd be tired when you got there.
So he never did teach there?
No, indeed.
Or give lectures
that we know
or anything
of.
That we know
oh,
of?
Oh, he taught at his home. He had apprentices.
Yes, I know, but he did not give lectures at Transylvania or anything
like
that.
No, that I know of, no. And I doubt very much if he did, no matter who says so.
Now, there's also this story that is probably false, too, but I want to see what you think, about people standing outside while he was doing the surgery waiting to hang him if she died.
That's absolutely apocryphal crap.
Okay.
And I can't tell you anything else more emphatic, because you couldn't spell it. But I think that's just unadulterated crap. Because he was so well respected, there was nobody going to be. And how many people knew he was going to operate Jane Todd Crawford? Did they just saw her on the horse and coming up to see him? Oh, that's no reason to assume that she's going to be operated on.
Now, does the fact that that tumor got so large tell you anything about the doctors down there and their skills down in Greene County?
I don't know how big it was.
Really. Well, it weighed 22 pounds,
apparently.
Yeah, that's
apparently. Fairly size. If they weighed it right.
Well, that's
and
true.
I don't know who weighed it.
The way I understand it was done, now, you know more about it than I do, he weighed it when he drained it. Dr. McDowell had someone weigh it when he drained it or something.
Well, he weighed it before he drained it.
Oh, did he?
Oh, I'm sure. Because otherwise you wouldn't know how much it weighed. Because the capsule didn't weigh very much. It's what was in it, the fluid.
Right.
See, water has a very high specific weight. And you get fluid in it, and it's going to be increased in weight. But he knew the size of the tumor, and he even devised, I'm not sure that's right, but he examined her standing up, so he knew where it was.
That's why I find it confusing that they would have thought that she was pregnant, because a tumor just is nothing like a baby, is it?
Don't fool yourself.
Well, I had the same surgery done.
Okay.
When I was 20.
Uh-huh.
And I had cysts on both ovaries.
Uh-huh.
And at first they did tell me I was pregnant, which I couldn't have been because I was...
Well.
But, you would think, and of course, maybe they didn't have it in that day and time, but in this day and time, you could tell instantly because there would be no heartbeat and that kind of thing, right? Would there be a difference in it?
But I don't think they thought to listen to a mass in the belly, except if they were convinced it was a fetus. And usually the mother would tell you whether it had a heartbeat or not. You didn't have to listen for it.
Well, do you have anything else you'd like to tell about this, or any other thoughts on all of this?
No, except that I think the reason he was successful was he was in an isolated community. He washed his hands, and he was not contaminated by other activities as far as dissection is concerned. If you dissect a lot, you can't get your hands clean. We can today, but they didn't even scrub them with a brush. Clean hands were clean hands that have been washed with soap. And if you've used homemade soap, some of it soap's good, some of it doesn't. I sure in hell, I've been whipped two or three times and sent back out to the pump because I didn't wash my hands. Well, hell I did. My wife used the ball of soap that was homemade. That's what we had outside.
Where was your home?
Well, my home was in, I was born and raised in Baltimore, but I lived the summers in Newark, Delaware, all over the place. Both my mother and my dad were Delawareans.
And what made you become interested in medicine?
Well, I was interested in, I cleaned all the animals that I shot, and we ate everything. And so my dad would tell me what was this and what was that. And something else because he knew from somebody telling him. And I got interested in anatomy and comparative anatomy when I was in college. And I was interested in medicine because I liked physiology. And I liked physiology and anatomy. I wasn't particularly red hot. I had to, everybody wants to be a surgeon. I didn't care about that because I knew how you did surgery. I'd seen enough of it done. And so I was interested in the patients and the care of the patients. I guess that's what I went to medical school for. And I learned from patients, of course.
And you went to the school in Pennsylvania?
No, I went to University of Maryland to medical school.
Did you?
Yes, ma'am, in Baltimore. And then I went in the Army after my internship. And then after we got back and I finished, I did a residency 1 year in Baltimore at the University of Maryland. Then I went to Penn. And we went there for 1 year and stayed 9.
Okay.
And I left Penn when they called me down here to look at this. And I decided I'd take a chance on it. And I've been glad ever since. And this has been a great move for us to come here, because Philadelphia is a hell of a rough place now. It's bad enough then. And here, people were, I think they were more sociable, certainly. And maybe it's just the people I met casually. People here were much better mannered and more interested in the individual than in you, than in what you're doing or what, or who you belong to. In Philadelphia, if you didn't belong to somebody important, why wasn't any sense in fooling with you? That's the truth.
I can believe you.
Damn right.
I'm from the South.
Yeah, that's right.
I see a big difference in the attitude of the people, it seems to me, further north. And Kentucky's kind of
in between
southern
that.
And in between.
I think Kentucky customs and mannerisms are a very good blend of both North and South. And it works out very nicely, I think. A lot better than one or the other.
Probably so.
Well, they wouldn't agree with you, but I think, I can't think of anything else to say.
Well, let me just touch on something else just a minute then before we finish. I had thought about this while we were talking. Your activities on the board.
Yeah.
McDowell House.
Well,
tell us a little bit about that.
One thing that stands out in my mind, I was appointed chairman of a committee to raise funds here, I don't know how long ago, and we did raise considerable money. And I didn't know anything about raising money. And I didn't like to do it. But I had a lot of friends, physicians, former students that were physicians. And so we gathered quite a bit of money for the McDowell House, and it helped out a lot. And I think it's still helping.
Good.
And, but you see, the State Medical Society, to their credit, they were supporting the McDowell House. They didn't have anybody there full time. And the local physicians kind of kept their fingers on it and made sure that it didn't tumble down. But the state medical society didn't have any great wealth. And so I think, first of all, the local people were the ones that kept him alive. Then the PWA,
WPA,
WPA, mm-hmm. whatever the hell the difference was, they were both giving out money. And so it was the WPA. When they, and I don't remember off the top of my head how much money they gave, but that was a great help. And it was judiciously, as near as I can tell, it was judiciously used to take, to repair the property mm-hmm. and to ultimately to maintain it to some extent. It, the local people recognized, local physicians and some in Lexington in the state medical society recognized that this needed to be kept. Well, hell, one time it's going to be sold and taken to Chicago.
The house?
Yes, indeed. The whole damn kit and caboodle.
Why would it have been taken there?
Because some son of a bitch had enough money, wanted it there.
Oh.
For the World's Fair or something.
Really?
Yeah. And then it would have left it there and they'd have burned it down or something. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
The house has quite a history.
Oh, yeah, it does.
And I didn't know. There are a lot of things I've learned doing these interviews about
yeah,
that house.
I expect so. But the business of wanting to move, buy the house and move it to Chicago, I just can't believe anybody is that conceited. But, of course, there's all kinds of so-and-sos going around. And this guy had enough money to buy it, or he thought he did. Fortunately, the people, the local people that were looking after it or taking care of it, didn't like an idea, fortunately.
Right.
See, there's not been a lot of strength exercised by the state medical society except to, first of all, buy it and keep it.
That was quite a bit, though.
Oh, heck yeah. Because otherwise it might have been torn down.
Mm-hmm. From the condition it looked like it was in, it wouldn't be standing today.
Well, no, but I've been all over that house where you can't walk, you know, in the eaves and everything. But it was a well-built house. And fortunately, the WPA came along and could put the roof on. It didn't have, it was leaking and everything, and they repaired the plaster walls. I don't know how extensive the preparation, the repair of them was, but I would bet they had to damn near rebuild that house. You know, certainly inside and some outside.
Now, are you still in a role of raising money for the building, for the house?
Yes. The Women's Auxiliary of the State Medical Society raises funds every year for the McDowell House. And we get some given to us. How much is given and how much is given by the medical society, what percent it is, I don't know. My guess is we get the most money for support of the house from the state medical society. And
so it's still very active in the
yes,
protection of
yes,
it.
Yes, indeed. Boy, there's a few of the old guys that haunt you if something happened to that house. Yeah, that it was really a very important thing that these few physicians thought that It ought to be salvaged.
Now, how do you keep the younger physicians aware of the importance of that? How do you keep them interested so that when the people who have been supporting it are gone, there will still be people who will care about it?
It's very difficult because in today's world, the physician has to work every day or he can't make a living. And in when this was started, say, in 1840, a doctor didn't have to work but one day a week, almost, you know, depending on where he was and who he had. He might get a small flock of sheep in October for something he'd done in the previous 3 years or 1 year or whatever. But he didn't know how much money he was going to have at the end of the year. And to have these physicians say, look, we got to salvage that place, save it, that was a pretty big step.
Mm-hmm.
And they deserve a lot of credit for that. Because it got other people interested in it, see, other than the local people. And, of course, focusing really on Ephraim McDowell is what helped. You know, that's what made it possible to get the house or save the house. It was McDowell himself, you know, talking about not the professor or the him.
When a young man goes to medical school today, is he taught about Dr. McDowell and the history of what
if
he did?
If I have a chance to, I teach him. When I used to give the lectures in medical history, there was a whole session on McDowell. Because, see, he not only diagnosed the tumors, or tumor in the pelvis, and extracted it surgically, that started out the whole surgical business of opening the peritoneum. It demonstrated you could do it and the patient survived, which was very important.
I remember reading about a Dr. Wise, I believe, who was from Sweden, maybe, or Switzerland, who started the whole process of hygiene when you worked with a patient. And it was very interesting to me. It was like one man made such a difference in the whole medical field, the way they saw things, you know, washing your hands and taking care of your hygiene
of your patients.
I'm
not acquainted with his name.
So is, and Dr. McDowell would be equivalent in the area of surgery, I guess, to that. One man could make that much difference.
Oh, by all means, yes.
Well, did doctors start at that point to realize that they did have to use good hygiene when they did surgery, or was that part of it, of his influence at all?
Well, whoever went there and watched him work, now he didn't do six cases a week or six in one day like they do today. He probably did, I don't know, I once counted it up. Figured it out. He'd go a whole year and not do but one case.
One surgery?
Yeah, one surgery. For tumor of the ovary, he would do, as I said a while back, he was most famous for extracting calculi or stones from the bladder. And so he was well known as a operator, as a surgeon, but mostly what he did was take stones out of the bladder. And then he got so good at taking ovaries out, or tumors of the ovary, he became, I don't know, but I think he, about that time, was cutting down on how much surgery he was doing on the bladder. because he didn't have time enough.
Now, did her surgery, if she had been able to have any, was she, would she have been able to have children after she had that surgery, or did he just removed the tumor and that was it?
Well, as near as we know, yes. And the one ovary was already non-functional, the one that was a tumor. So she probably still could have conceived. I don't know. How the hell old was she? Can't remember that either. I'm getting to the age that I have to review all this.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly do thank you for giving me your time today.
Thank you.
And for doing this for me.
For asking me.
And I appreciate it very much.
He was a truly great man. We don't have too many of them. And as near as I know, he never promoted himself. He was no IM. And
that says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, and in today's world, that's a rare bird. I think he was a gentleman, and he had read a lot, and he went, and he knew he had to have an education, so he went where the education. Scotsmen knew that Edinburgh was a center of education, and his father knew that. So that's the reason he went, I'm sure. None of them had been there to come back until, I guess, until Ephraim went and came back. I don't know of anybody in Danville that had been to Scotland, but there probably was. You know, there's a lot of family and commercial intercourse across the ocean.
Now, there were some other doctors there, Dr. Hun, Dr. Polk, and some other doctors there at various times, but I'm not sure if they were contemporaries of Dr. McDowell or not. But one of the questions that came up before was that who would have encouraged him to go there unless it was someone who had gone there? But that's not necessarily true, is it? I mean, anyone who knew the reputation of the school could have encouraged
him. No, I didn't think he needed any encouragement to go there. There was written word about the school at Edinburgh. And the clinical training that was available there, not sponsored by the school, but associated there in the community, in the medical community. So I think he knew what he was looking for, and he went and looked for it. And it's really absolutely amazing, because they, in Philadelphia, which was where medical teaching started in 1765 in America. They had a hospital there, the Pennsylvania Hospital, which is still there, the same damn building. It's still there. Yes, indeed it is. And it's got the same entrance still.
Really?
It's not used except for formal occasions. And on each side of the iron stairway, there's wisteria, which was planted by Dr. Caspar Wistar, for whom the plant is named. And it's on each side of the doorway.
Was he one of the first doctors there?
One of the first, yeah, that's easy enough. Just trying to think. He was one of the first. He wasn't the first. that Caspar Wistar was an anatomist and a surgeon and a fabulous teacher, apparently. He'd give you a lecture right walking in off of the street. He could give you a sensible, very well thought out lecture. And not too many people can do that. He was fabulous, though. Wistar was. I guess they pronounce it Wister.
What nationality was that name?
I think it was British. I'm not sure. Damn. Some things you forget fast. I've forgotten a hell of a lot in 80-some years. I'll be 88 in December.
Really?
Yep.
Would never believe it.
Thank you. But some of the things disappear from your recall.
Some of the things probably are better off to be able to forget,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and...
Quite welcome.